Good evening. At this time, we begin the second man on line mark. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. I'm along with Mel, K2KEY, Kilo Echo Yankee. We're going to try to answer people's questions with the help of our friend who also signed in. Put this in the tech net. You guys have heard it only a few thousand times. Give information about the fairly complicated hobby of ham radio. How do I make my antennas and my feed lines work better? What transmitter should I buy? How do I know if my receiver is working correctly? What is propagation like? How many modes of operation are there? Even questions of interest to radio amateurs that involve electronics are considered appropriate for the segment. Occasionally we even touch on aviation and allied pieces of technology. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Vic your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. Well, you could say no. So do we have any check-in tonight? Please give me your call letters, name, and that yes or no. K2LIW.
W-A-2-L-I-Y. Joe, question. Yes.
No, and yes.
T-J-P-W, Lou, yes.
Okay. We had Joe and Lou and another person. Who is that other person?
Evening, Liz, K-E-Y.
Mel recognized, but so far we've got Mel, Joe, R-Y-Y, and Lou, K-P-W. Anyone else would like to check in? Give me your call list and name at this time.
K-2-I-A-K.
Abe. Okay, Abe, A-I-H-H. Alpha Bravo Echo, I think it's Abe. Let's start off with Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. What would you like to talk about tonight, Joe? And how things in Patchogue?
I don't know because I don't live there.
Shows you what I know. I thought you lived on the South Shore, and I might be wrong. Over to you, Joe.
I do, but you know what it is? You can't seem to forget my brother, and you keep on mixing me up with him, and that's part of the problem. He's over in North Patchogue, and I'm over in Sayville, okay? Anyway, I'd like to talk about antennas, return loss, and measuring signal strength from a given transmitter source at a distance, all combined into one talk-em-up. So I'm not sure what kind of information I should start with here. Let's see, I have a beam, and I have a station master. Station master is a 7.5 dB gain station master. They're both fed with, one's fed with LMR-400, one's fed with half-inch heliacs. Operating at different parts of the bands, the beam looks like it has very good return loss in the area of the band I'm trying to use it for. But yet it receives a signal in that part of the band worse than the station master.
Is the Yagi vertically polarized? How many elements? Where's it aimed? Over to you, Joe.
The Yagi is vertically polarized. It's aimed west from my house because it's receiving a signal from Bayshore. And I'm going to look up there and tell you how many elements it is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So it's not quite a 10 dB antenna, because I think a 7-element antenna is about 10 dB as far as the Yagi goes. This one's a little less than that, apparently.
And are they both at a similar altitude, Joe?
As far as the top of the station master, it's taller than the Yagi by about maybe 10, maybe 15 feet on an average, but they both have a fairly clear path to the west. They're not looking into trees.
Okay. Which one has the half-inch heliac? Is the heliac foam or airtight? Go ahead.
Heliac is LDF-4-50 on the station master. It's about maybe, 35 feet cable, 30, 35 feet, something like that. Other bands are 50 feet, definitely. The beam antenna has LMR 400, and that's about maybe 60 feet of cable. So I don't know if there's a substantial difference in loss on the antenna circuit between the two. I wouldn't think there should be a tremendous night and day difference. Do you?
Well, let's hold on. You haven't mentioned which bands these are on, Joe.
Okay. The station master is a 440 to 450 station master, and the beam is operating in the 430 to 440 frequency range.
Alrighty. Now, what testing have you done that leads you to believe that the Yagi is not working as well as the station master? Were you using the Yagi on 432 and the station master on 445, so to speak? And the guy who was doing the transmitting to you, you think he was transmitting the exact same amount of power? Give me a few more details. And what's the nature of the discrepancy? Is the Yagi a half a dB low or 5 dB low from your measurements? But first of all, how did you do those measurements, Joe? KQLIW.
Let's talk to the return. Talk about the return loss first. And once I give you those kind of numbers on the beam of depth first, the beam seems to be centered the best in the 430 to 440 frequency. 430 to 440 frequency range. I'll give you specifics. 433.2 shows the return loss. This is measured with a bridge on my service monitor. It shows a return loss of minus 24. At 438.7. It shows the return loss also of minus 24. 448.5, the return loss goes up to minus 12. 443.5, the return loss is minus 18. And the only other point they get the return loss to go to minus 12 is as far down as 396.5. So that gives you maybe an approximate figure or a picture of the bandwidth I'm talking about here.
Roger. Now tell me what the station master looks like.
Okay, the plots I did on the station master was also, let's see, 448.5 minus 26, 443.5 minus 32, 438.7 minus 26, 433.2 minus 14.
The minus 14, what was the frequency of that again?
443.2.
Okay, 443.2 is minus 14. One of the numbers was minus 32. What was the frequency of that?
Excuse me, I got the wrong information. On the station, I'll repeat it again. Station is 448.5 minus 26. 443.5 minus 32, 438.7 minus 26, 433.2 minus 14. I said 433.2. So those are the important parts of the band I did plot on as far as return loss.
Okay. So I don't waste my time telling you things you already know. When it comes to measuring efficiency of an antenna, in other words, the point where it might be half a dB low in gain because of reflection energy, because of any wave ratio of reflected energy. Where do you believe the threshold of grief is, Joe? In other words, what number of dB of reflected energy are you alarmed at where it's now going to make a measurable difference in gain? Back to you, Joe.
Well, I'm not so much worried about gain as far as reflective power going back in the transmitter. I pretty much stop at like minus 12 to minus 14. That starts becoming a little more than 5% reflective power, and above that I try not to use it if I can help it. Okay, so you have the return loss plots. Okay, a signal at a given distance, which is about approximately 10 miles away, on approximate frequency of, I don't need the exact frequency here, do I? But say on a 448 frequency, coming from a transmitter, remotely keyed up, it produces a signal into the beam of minus 94 dBm. another frequency used at the same location into a directional antenna pointed east back at me on a 438 frequency from that same location, running half the power of the repeater. The repeater's running 40 watts. They both use LDF-4-50, approximately 40 feet of cable on each length, so it's up to 50 feet, I believe. Maybe it could be as much as 50 feet. The repeater's running, say, 40 watts, and the link coming back to me is running 20 watts. So I know right there I've got a 3 dB difference. The station master at the transmitting end is a 5 dB gain antenna. The beam at the other end, I believe is a 7-element Yagi, at least a 7-element Yagi. So it's supposed to be yielding a 10 dB gain, I believe, if I'm right on that. So the beam should be similar to the station master. Now, measuring it back on the beam, I received the 448 frequency at minus 94 and the 438 frequency at minus 105. Now, station master gives me higher readings.
Okay, if the beam is minus 94 and the station master is minus 105 at 438, that seems like it's lower, not higher. I'm confused.
Looking at the remote, two transmitters. One is a repeater transmitter, one is a link. Okay. 448 frequency is minus, this is all on the beam antenna, receiving from the beam. 448 frequency is minus 94, the 438 frequency is minus 105. Now if I look at these signals coming into my station master, the 448 frequency is minus 80. And the 438 frequency is minus 100.
Okay. The station master on the 448, beam was minus 94, station master minus 80. That's a 14 decibel increase. That's a lot. I know that what you're listening to is different in direction and different in frequency and different in antennas. Therefore, there's a lot of variables involved. I do recommend that you do a best estimate of effective radiated power. If you're putting 10 watts into an antenna with 10 dB of gain, that would be 100 watts of effective radiated power. So when you normalize things to effective radiated power of each of those sources, I wonder if you've done that, Joe, and I wonder if you then see a discrepancy that's understandable. And it's one of the factors you've got to put in here. Boil everything down to what is the effective radiated power of the thing that's doing the transmitting. That's factor number one. That's going to be a function of transmitter power, rough estimate of feed line loss, and rough estimate of antenna gain. Second factor is going to be, is the number of miles to each of the sources the same? Third factor, is the terrain the same? Do you have line of sight in one situation, but there's a forest of trees in the other situation? So with those multiple sources you described, what do you believe is the common denominator in their effective radiated power, range, and the clearance that the signal has to flow through? Back to you, Joe.
Okay, the transmitting equipment at the far end, well, first of all, my eyes, the station master is not up terribly high. It's maybe 25 feet to the base of the station master, so that puts it at that 11-foot antenna. So it's a little over, like, 36 feet, something like that, to the top of the antenna. The beam is mounted on a tripod, and that's about maybe 25 feet above the ground, approximately. So that's a very, very similar altitude to the bottom of the station master. So the station master, as far as the top, is higher than the beam, relative relative feet. It's receiving from a source that's about 120 feet above ground level, so it's pretty much above the tree line, as far as me looking at it. The average trees around me going in that 50 foot on average, give or take. But I don't have any really large trees directly in front of either antenna, so they're not really causing a reflection. So both signal sources are emanating from the same building at the same approximate altitude at that building.
Okay, you did say something that's a little troubling, and that is Station Master and Yagi are both mounted approximately 25 feet above the ground. Base of Station Master and Yagi, 25 feet above the ground, and trees, you said, are 50 feet high. That sounds like you're below the tree line. And if so, do you have to go through one tree or a whole block, a quarter of a mile of trees, before you get clearance out to the source? Back to you, Joe.
Let's see. I would say looking in a western direction, I don't have any trees directly in front of each antenna. There's trees to the south of me, but looking directly west, the nearest trees are probably about, I would say 500 feet away from me, because there's a house west of me, no trees at that house. There's low bushes and stuff like that, but they're not anywhere near as high as the antenna or even the house, so then they don't count. And going to the west side of the next block around the corner from me. So the tree line is probably maybe, I don't know, let's say 500 feet. I'd say the trees are probably about 500 feet away because they're behind the people bobbing in the houses. So they're probably 400 to 500 feet away from me. And I'm looking into those trees. So they're not something like I'm looking into something directly in front of me that's twice as high as the antenna. They're higher, but they're a lot further away.
Okay, the trees are a variable. The two antennas are not in the exact same location. One of the things that I've seen happen on occasion is that the local obstacles are giving reflections. Those reflections are creating fingers of signal in space, where you've seen it on multiple occasions where you're listening to a signal with your handy-talkie and you move a couple of feet to the left and the right, and the signal can go from below threshold to gangbusters, dead full quieting to gangbusters, just by moving a couple of feet with your handy-talkie. So your two antennas are not co-located. They are horizontally translated, even though they're vertically close to the same altitude, because some of that signal is sifting through trees, reflecting off ground and whatever. Favorable and unfavorable multipath is a factor. Now, the fact that you've measured rather good-sounding standing wave ratios, reflection coefficients, very helpful. Every antenna will obey conservation of energy. Of all the transmitter power you put into the antenna, if the antenna is made out of lossless materials, and you can find that out real fast by putting 100 watts to it for 10 minutes and turning off the transmitter and going over there and touch everything, if the antenna is cold, it's not wasting power. So of all the power you put into a lossless antenna, it can only do two things, radiate into space or reflect it back to the transmitter. And when you measure reflection coefficient, if you had 10 dB reflection coefficient, fancy way of saying 1/10 the power is coming back to you, that's a fancy way of saying 90% of the power is being transmitted. And that puts you something like half a dB down. So, and you're not talking about half a dB of difference here. So standing wave ratio is not accounting for what you're talking about. 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is where the average manufacturer makes an antenna at the end of the band, and he calls that good. Let me drop. And 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is a reflection coefficient of minus 9.5 dB. So minus 9.5 is not bad if you think that 2-to-1 is not bad. I'll admit that some transmitters, particularly on HF, these no-tune type transmitters, some of them will start cutting back in power or flipping into the standby mode when they see anything more than 1.5 or 1.6 standing wave ratio, which I guess is something more like a 2018 or so dB reflection coefficient, in that order. I'm estimating now, but you know how to look that up. So standing wave ratio doesn't account for it. Feed line loss, you've got some good quality cable there, and as long as there isn't water in one of them. Now, at the 432 band, I have seen a single drop of water, good-sized drop of water, inside of a type N connector, bridging the gap between the semiconductor and the outer conductor in the connector, a single drop of water I have personally seen it create 10 decibels of loss on 432. Water is a very lossy substance. And naively, I used to think that, well, I'll just pour some power through there and boil it out. Don't waste your time. Because you've got to think about what's happening. When you try to boil the water out, where's it going to go? It's going to become steam. It's going to force itself into the foam. And you're still going to get the loss of the water. When water is in the connection, you've got to really mop it up, find out how it got in there, stop it from happening, and so on. Dry out the connector. So water in the connector is one factor. I used to make my 432 Yagi with insulator-driven elements so that I could use an ohm meter in the shack between center conductor and shield, and therefore I could find out if there's water in any one of my 32 connectors when I had 16 Yagis up there. Because if the whole system was dry, it would measure a couple of megohms. And as water started getting in there, it would start coming down from 500K, 200K, eventually 60 kilo-ohms, so to speak, when you really got water in a connector and you saw an appropriate amount of loss. So another factor with the Yagi is that the Yagi has got a horizontal and vertical beamwidth, and you got to make sure it's really both sides on the site. I'm going to assume you've done that. In the case of the Station Master, as long as it's properly tilted, no problem. It's an omnidirectional antenna. It's got a pancake pattern. So you've got a little bit of a mystery there as to how you've got, in one case, 14 decibels of difference, which you think cannot be accounted for by the transmitter. But you could get 14 dB of difference because of multiple reflections of the signal sifting through the trees. And even though you've got a direct path that maybe clears the trees in certain directions, the fact that the trees are there means that the signal is still reflecting off of them. And sometimes the reflection off of those trees are going to be in phase or out of phase with the direct path signal. And so,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
I know it's hard to do. You can't easily walk your tower or walk that beam. The next best thing you could do, though, is to use a 432 handy talkie. Hold it on top of a stepladder or whatever, on top of the tower, in the vicinity of each of these antennas, and translate it left and right, forward and back, up and down, polarization or whatever. And a handy talkie, particularly if you put a 5 dB, 10 dB, 15 dB pad between the rubber duck antenna, and the rest of the rig, you can easily get it down to the point where you can easily see the bars on the chart. It's got a single strength indicator, RSSI, what's it called now? Receiver remote single strength indicator, RS single strength indicator, or just by listening to how close to dead quiet you are. So that's the next experiment I would want to do with a handy talkie, walk it back and forth, left and right, up and down, see what's happening in the vicinity where your antenna is, see if there really is a null in space at that point. And because every RF path, with rare exception, has a tremendous amount of multipath, you'd be kind of amazed what goes on. When I like listening to this particular repeater, the Limark repeater, in the morning, while I'm shaving, I'm in the bathroom with the handy talkie, and I set the handy talkie vertically, and I'm on 300 feet above sea level land. I should have a great path to Glen Oak. And with my handy talkie vertical, I get a very noisy signal. If I lay this handy talkie horizontal on the counter, on a wooden counter, plastic counter, the signal peaks up to be dead full climbing. So that vertical signal coming from this repeater through a line of sight path into my bathroom, because of the multipath and the scrambling of the signal, it arrived horizontally polarized to me in almost every corner of my bathroom. When I go to the living room, I can find some spots where vertically is the strongest. But a lot of the places in my house, that signal is horizontal. So, for all we know, something funny like that's going on in your particular case, Joe. I know we haven't really answered your question, but at least we've discussed some of the variables. So the A2RYY, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2KY with a comment?
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, does it vary? Do you see any kind of change at all from seasons? In other words, when the foliage is in blue, or we have a nice cold, crispy day where it's icy of any sort around, do you see any appreciable change, in other words, from in climate change, or I should say in seasonal change? change, go over.
No, can't answer that because the simple fact is that the equipment is only installed recently as far as on the second operating frequency. So I have not had a way to compare two frequencies from the same site. All right? I could look at one frequency, but I didn't do that 6 months ago or a year ago. So I don't have that as an option. I'd have to remember what I wrote down today and check it, say, 6 months from now and see if I get similar readings or not. But I am going to do one thing up there, which I'll probably come back next week and give you some more information. I'm going to change operating frequencies at the remote location and actually change my link frequencies I'm using and actually reverse them. And instead of transmitting down on 438, I'll be transmitting out on 433. So I want to see if just simply changing frequencies, if that makes any difference. Because I saw a return loss of minus 24 on, like 433.2 and 438.7. They both show minus 24 as far as looking into the beam. So I want to see if just changing frequencies, if that makes an appreciable difference, then that would pretty much nail it. That's the reflection problem I'm getting.
And when you say reflection, you don't mean reflection of standing wave ratio of the antenna itself. You mean multipath. And yes. See, there's something like 1,000 wavelengths or maybe 5,000 wavelengths between you and the source. By the time the signal goes 5,000 wavelengths and sifts to the trees, bounces off the ground, the buildings, the water towers, and everything else that's in the vicinity, and all of those individual signals are individual voltages in space that all arrive at your antenna. And all those voltages add up in a vector manner. Vector manner means they add up in polarity as well as amplitude. So in the worst case, if the direct signal through the air and the composite of all the signals reflecting off the ground and the trees, that they both were a 1 microvolt signal, but they're 180 degrees out of phase, I'll tell you what would happen. You get a pretty deep null. So by shifting frequency, you will discover that the pattern in space will also shift. What happens many times, a guy will be using his handy talky in a noisy area, in an area where he doesn't have good coverage. So he walks around the room, puts the handy talky up and down, left and right, locates the polarization, finds the spot where he hears the signal the best from the repeater. Then he transmits from that spot, and everyone says, "Boy, you sound terrible." He chooses another spot where when he's listening, he doesn't hear as good a signal, and he transmits, and they say, "Boy, you're beautiful in that spot." You say, "What in the world's going on?" Well, the 600 kc of difference between transmit and receive on this repeater can make a significant difference when you're 10, 20, 30 miles away as to what signal level you get. That little bit of difference in frequency, the 600 kc, makes an entirely different pattern in three-dimensional space as to where the signals peak up and null out, because you got so darn many miles and so darn many wavelengths. So that would be a good experiment. Please come back and tell us what you find out when you do that show. Did we discuss all the subjects you want to discuss? And I know you didn't get an answer, but as I said, we know more of the variables. So B2RYY, any final, K2RYW in the tech net.
Well, that was subject number one, okay? So I'm not going to beat this one to death too much because I think you pretty much answered. So you think, I don't expect you to be like Mr. Wizard and answer every question asked upon you, but you know what? You gave it a pretty damn good shot, and that's all that matters right now. So I think it's a reflection problem, a reflectivity problem as far as the antenna receiving the signal. The second question, I don't know if you can really answer this or not. This has to do with an old question I asked several tech nets ago about frequency stability of these transmitters that are running up in the UHF television band.
Okay, you told us the subject, and I don't have specific information as to what is their real stability and accuracy. Obviously, Eric KE2EJ does. He's in the industry. He works there. He set up some of the transmitters you're listening to and will be listening to with our new digital television standard that's going to become the regulation at midnight, February 17th, for the February 23rd, I think February 17th, 2009. So at the stroke of midnight, at the beginning at the beginning of 2009, February 18th, you either have digital television reception capability or you're not going to watch television. Somebody have a comment on this one?
I'm here, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric. Joe, why don't you ask your question? Eric is here to answer it.
Hello, Eric. 82EJWHOLAY. Okay. This has to do with frequency stability of some of those markers I've seen on the air. Today I happen to use a receiver that was capable of receiving, it's actually on 7,000, which tunes pretty much anywhere between like 25 to 1,000 meg. I'll give you some frequencies. Let's see. 524.3094. I measured that plus 50. And I'm also, to get the accuracy, I'm actually zero beating a signal into the receiver with a generator. So that tells me it was aligned to the other thing I talked about a while ago, the VHF frequencies, using that standard. So cool. At 524.3094, I saw a plus 53 hertz measurement of that frequency. When I went down to the next channel down, which I don't know who this is, if this is one of yours or whatever, I didn't see the marker at 309.4. I actually saw it at 518.3325, and I showed that at plus 62 hertz. So there's a discrepancy right there.
All right. Well, I don't know if I had explained to you before that not everybody is using the Tega Megahertz standard for running their transmitter, so you're going to find some variation. I don't have the specs in front of me, but I think the last time I read off exactly what the stability and the acceptable drift in frequency is, which isn't much, by the way.
I don't have that exact information written down, but I want to recall it's down to a tenth of a hertz or some incredibly small number, which is a lot finer than I can't believe even measuring. But you would think, out of all the transmitters that are out there, that some of them probably are using a similar system that you're using, correct?
Yes and no. There is a wide variety of yes and no. Some people that are using temporary transmitters, for example, on Empire, there's a station that's 716 megahertz, is it? It's up there. They will be gone, Joe. And they only had a small temporary transmitter, and I don't think they drove it from a GPS box, so. You can kind of consider that until February 17th of next year comes around, that there's going to be some variation before the real hard rules kick in and get enforced.
Right, I kind of gathered that would be the definitive point in time when all this stuff changes. But going back to my initial quest, what I'm trying to find is something that I can rely on to be somewhere near a pretty good measurement standard that I can compare one to another and say, okay, I measure them all the same. They have to be on frequency because that's what they are. That's all I'm trying to achieve with something like this. Because I measure quite a bit of variation on some of these frequencies on the 3L. Because I found quite a few carriers that had, I'll give you an example, 530.3094 that showed plus 26 hertz. The next one up I found is over here, 554.3094. That was minus 64 hertz. So I am seeing some variation up and down on these things.
All right, well, there's one other issue. You're trying to measure the pilot, right?
No, I'm trying to measure the frequency accuracy of what I'm looking at. That's what I'm trying to do, not measure the power.
Well, I mean, you are trying to measure symbols that are moving. There is no single carrier in the signals. I mean, right there is a problem in terms of trying to make a measurement. There is no one single carrier that you can actually say, this is a carrier, and it's not. There's no FMing going on. There's no AMing going on.
Well, I'm not looking at, I can't, as far as isolation on these frequencies I'm looking at, they look to be like, it's almost like a CW carrier. I can't see any modulation on them. And I don't know enough about the DTB subject to be able to answer what that carrier is there for. You could, of course. I'm just trying to use it, or get an idea, if I can use it, as a frequency source off the air for making accurate frequency measurements to align my service monitor to. That's what I'm attempting to do.
Now, let me ask you this one, Eric. Is there a pilot tone, a weak pilot tone, buried in the digital television signal at the low end, maybe at the high end, where if you use a narrow enough resolution bandwidth on a spectrum analyzer, you can pick out that essentially unmodulated narrow tone, which I think is a pilot signal for synchronizing everything? Back to you, Eric.
Yeah, there's a pilot signal. It's down at the bottom. At the lower edge of the band. And it's not a carrier. It actually has... hang on a minute while I open up my book, which I happen to have here, and I'll tell you exactly what it is. It really uses a training signal, or it was used as a training signal, and it actually served no purpose at this particular point with most receivers. But give me a minute, I'll be right back.
Okay. We'll continue discussing various things until you come back. Anything along these lines, I can see what you're trying to do, Eric. I mean, Joe. No matter where you drive around the New York City area, if you have any doubt as to the accuracy of your service monitor, you'd like to be able to look for that power tone of a digital television broadcast, and do that as a confirmation. Is that your idea? Go ahead.
Yes. Like I stated previously, when we had this discussion many, many tech nets ago, I found two frequencies that didn't have any variation between them at 199.260. That's a regular, you know, video carrier. But the carrier itself, and measuring another one at 187.260, those carriers, as far as I can tell, are on the same exact frequency. There's no difference between measuring one to the other. So if you've got two carriers that are exactly the same, that would probably tell me they're probably on frequency.
Good guess. By the way, when you use a ICOM R7000, depending on the accuracy of your particular reference oscillator, I think it's a 10 meg oscillator in there, straight out of the box, when you're measuring a VHF signal, we can easily measure 1.5 kilohertz of error. And also it's got a warm-up characteristic. At least mine does. I think mine drifts a healthy kilohertz as it warms up, maybe a little more. So, but there's ways you can plug in a more accurate oscillator or learn the warm-up characteristics of your particular oscillator of your R7000 and so on. When Eric comes back, one of the questions I want to ask Eric is that is Channel 13, over the last month or so, maybe 2 months, putting out the same power it used to a year ago? I'm getting a tiny bit more signal, tiny bit more snow on my rooftop antenna than I used to. K2EJ, if you're there, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RAW, K2EJ. They've been doing a lot of antenna work up on Empire. I'm putting the effort into the digital antenna. As far as I'll put a channel 13, it's still 25 kilowatts coming out of that transmitter. Although the antenna has changed somewhat. That helps me.
So I think you're saying the new antenna, or the change in the antenna, may make a slightly different strength of the lobe in my particular direction, is what I think you're saying is a possibility. It may have moved in elevation, azimuth, gain, beamwidth, whatever. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, if anything that's happened is the high Vs, they sit, there's two bays, one on top of each other, and they had, what happened to the four-way power divider blew up, so that guy was played. But as far as the actual antenna structure and radiation pattern, it should all be the same. The small combiner that puts 13, 11,
9 and 7 together, that has a change. It's not perfectly flat, it's a little bit bumpy, but in the last year, I wouldn't say that there's been anything that really affects a measurable change in output. Actually, I can go online and see if the transmitter is putting out the same amount of energy as it always does, but I suspect it is. Otherwise, I probably would have heard about it. I mean, they had air conditioning problems today, but not at Empire, but at the station. That shouldn't affect anything. So, now, I'm looking for the information on the pilot. So, give me another minute. I'll be right back.
Okay, K2RIW.
You got it, Joe?
Okay. I should have told you my method of measuring, so it probably would give you a better idea of what I'm doing. I'm only using the R7000 as a receiving source because it has fairly good sensitivity, better sensitivity than the service monitor by about a factor of probably 20 dB or so. We're pretty close to it. I'm using a directional coupler, actually a coupler sampling, one of these sampling couplers that has end fittings on it, and I'm putting the signal back into my antenna line from the service monitor. So when I find the frequency I receive with the R7000, I put a frequency in 1 kHz lower in frequency. In other words, like on the 524 frequency, the R7000 is 524.3094, my service monitor is 524.3084. So I theoretically should get a 1000 hertz beat note between the two. And what I do is, whatever beat note I get, I use the internal audio generator that's in the service monitor, which is accurate, very accurate, and I compare the two, and I can move the internal generator up and down until I get zero out the variation between the two, and that's how I come up with the frequency measurement down to the hertz. I am not using the R7000 strictly by itself as a measurement source, because I know it's definitely off either way.
Understand. Sounds like a good scheme. And now you're trying to confirm the accuracy of your service monitor. It probably has a master oscillator, maybe it's 10 megacycles, if it's an IFR. I'm not sure. And you can get your hands on, if it doesn't already have one of these Hewlett-Packard crystal oven 10 megacycle references that's used for their frequency counters. And I think some of those have enough accuracy where you could measure numbers like 100 hertz or 10 hertz of error up at 10 gigahertz, and you multiply it that far. So you multiply 10 megs to 10 gigs, and I guess that's 1,000 to 1 multiplication to get something like 50 hertz of error. We could boil that down in parts per million, but it's an awful nice number. So what do you believe is the quality of the oscillator, the master reference oscillator, that's in your service monitor? Thank you, Joe.
Comment at K2KEY.
Okay, yeah, Mel first, and then pass it over to Joe.
Okay, check the signals that are traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. How much accuracy can we depend on with them? I know you always refer to reference to NBS. So I was wondering, is that a viable source to check things like service monitors take over?
Well, that is the virgin shale bedrock of the frequency accuracy of this nation, Mr. Schneider. 1 part in 10 to the 14. The early issues, let me jump. The early issues of the IEEE proceedings that I used to see 10 and 20 and 30 years ago, in the first couple of pages or in the back pages, they would tell you what was the frequency accuracy of the signals transmitted by the National Bureau of Standards, Boulder, Colorado, or Maryland, where they used to be, for this particular day. In other words, each day they would tell you whether or not they were 1.5 hertz high out of 1 part in 10 to the 14. In other words, you write down their frequency, and the 14th decimal place is the one that's in error, because I think they're using either cesium beam, I think a cesium beam references, and the beating of, against each other with what's called the Adler-Paired variant technique for measuring frequency accuracy. So they're the best thing we got there. Now, unfortunately, the best thing we've got in Boulder is not that good when it gets to you and me. If you're listening to the 5, 10, 15, and 20 megacycle signal that's coming to you by way of the ionosphere, and the ionosphere is always in motion, therefore you're getting a continuous positive and negative of that signal. So unless you integrate it for a long period of time, what you get on HF frequencies is nowhere near that many decimal places of accuracy. However, if you're smart enough, there are ways you can choose the right signal coming from a satellite. Global positioning satellite is one very good one. The satellites that are transmitting color television, the synchronous orbit satellite. If you're watching a network program, the 3.57 meg, 3.579545 megacycle signal, which is the culminant subcarrier of old-fashioned NTSC television, the kind that's going to go away. When you're on a network locked-up program, the whole nation is in phase lock on that carrier. So there are smart people who have used that as a reference. But global positioning satellites are about the best reference you and I can get into our backyard. And even there, you've got a problem, because the satellite is moving at 6,000 miles an hour. And as it moves across the sky from your point of view, you hop from satellite to satellite. They're all on the same frequency, that's the good news, but because of their motion, you're looking through different chunks of atmosphere that have different densities because of the moisture and clouds and everything else. So even using global positioning satellite signal, 1,572 megacycles, to, as they say, discipline your oscillator, you want to have a very slow-moving servo mechanism that integrates that signal for a 10-minute or a 5.5-hour type period, some significant amount of time. Even on that particular satellite, you're getting to by direct line of sight, essentially no multipath, but you're trying to now take out minor variations of the atmosphere. That's about the best thing you would have.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's about the best thing we've got. And when it gets back to Eric, he's gonna correct some of the things I said. Joe, I know you want to make a comment. At A2RYY, A2RYW.
Right. You're talking about frequency accuracy as was, if I believe it, like a tenth of a hertz at 1,000 meg. You're talking about the 10 to the 14 or something like that. My transponder can only measure down to 1 hertz at 1, you know, 1 gig. In fact, if I can measure within 1 or 2 hertz at 1,000 meg, I'm happy. That's the end of the day. I just want to be able to get something somewhere in that near vicinity of what I can measure. So I know what you're saying about what the satellite accuracy can vary and so forth, but that far exceeds my measurement capacity of my instrument. So I wouldn't be able to tell if my instrument was off at half a hertz at 1,000 meg. I wouldn't know the difference.
You know, I think Eric, I know in New York City, I believe you're using the cesium beam reference to check things. KE2EJ, if you're on the way back, KE2RAW in the check now.
Yeah, no, the cesium beam is just used to, within the station itself. Actually, I don't think they're using it anymore. I'm using it out there. I'm playing with it. But when it finally gets through the devices to get it to the transmitter, all of that frequency standard is lost. It's just the local device at the transmitter site. So all those nice fancy things that you saw we were playing games with, pretty much a local within the plant, but don't actually make it to the transmitter.
Okay, any luck on the things you were looking up that you might want to announce to us?
Yeah, I'm almost there. Give me another minute.
Okay, in the meantime, we'll pick up Lou. He's been waiting long enough, and we're about to find out what's the state of the art in Allendale, New Jersey. 72KPW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2RIW in the TechNet. W2JPW. I just had a very simple question for you or anybody who's on tonight, and that is, I've gotten quite interested in 6 meters, to improve my setup here. Get an amp, maybe, and put the Yagi instead of on the roof on top of the tower. But what I'm wondering, before I do all this work, is what is going to happen as far as the 6 meters is concerned when the new digital standard goes in, which you've just been talking about, on February 18th or whenever it is next year. In other words, is the TBI situation that people get on 6 meters going to be improved, or is it going to be worse, or no change, whatever? I'm curious to know about that. And the second thing, also with relation to 6 meters, is that here we have, it's very nice in the summer when the humidity is high, but in the winter, or even on dry days in the summer, the noise on that band can get really, really awful. I have an old AMC4, which I was never very happy with on HF, which might work on that band. Have you seen or heard of anything that could be used as a phase noise canceller for that frequency? Or any kind of article, or anything at all that I might want to look at? K2RIW, TechNet, W2JPW.
Okay, in a minute I'm going to pass it over to Mel, who's done a fair amount of experimenting on noise-canceling circuits. But from my point of view, the very first step is to make sure that the receiver you're using has got a good noise blanker. And that's an extremely controversial subject. Each amateur you and I talk to has his favorite receiver, and he'll say that, boy, it's got a good noise blanker. He may believe it. But when it comes to the people who have really suffered with very, very severe noise, the guys in the early days of 1970 on 432 megacycles, when the Montauk radar used to be working, and with its 135-foot wide antenna and 10 megawatts of peak envelope power coming out of the transmitter, it was putting out a terawatt of power. It was potent. There were times when that antenna gave me 70 miles away a signal 120 dB above my noise. I could disconnect the antenna, and through the D-plus wiring of my 432 converter, I could hear that radar when the main bang and the main beam swept by me of that rotating antenna. They were potent. Okay. The experiments I did, and a few of the guys I was comparing with at the time, told me that essentially nobody had a better noise blanker in that time frame than the Drake R4T receiver. It had a field effect transistor, separate module called noise blanker, and when that radar was bombing the daylights out of me, where I could take the deepest notch of my antenna in the back lobe, aim it toward that radar, and listen during the time the radar has got its antenna aimed out over the Atlantic Ocean. So I'm in the back lobes of the radar, and I'm in the back lobe of my antenna at the deepest notch I can get, and the radar I was getting would still be 50 or 60 dB above noise. And as you tuned up and down the band, you heard that raspy thing sound noise every 500 hertz, every 300 hertz, and there was no way in hell you're going to hear anybody else on that band when that radar was on, unless the guy was 1 mile away from you hitting you with a kilowatt. You were not going to hear him. So that's what the radar was like. I would then aim the main beam of my antenna directly at the radar. And when the radar aimed its main beam at me as it swept by and dropped, I don't know for sure, but I'll bet you there's a chance I could have rectified enough power out of them that I could light a neon bulb. They were really potent. With my antenna directly aimed at that radar, and that beam of the radar directly aimed at me, I turned on the noise blanker of the Drake R4C receiver. The radar completely disappeared. An extremely weak guy on 432 in the back lobe of my antenna coming in from New Jersey while I'm into the east would be in their Q5. Night and day, huge difference. Very few other receivers come close. The Kenwood 520, I think it is. That's the model number of the sound thing I've got here. Yeah, Kenwood 520, TS520, has a noise blanker almost as good, but that Drake R4C is really potent. So the noise you're getting on the Magic Band
And even though we're at the bottom of the sunspot cycle, a nice thing about 6 meters is you're still going to have sporadic E openings and tropo openings and FAIs, and, field of line anomalies, and trans-equatorials. It's got a little bit of everything. That's why they call it the magic band. It's got moon bounce, it's got meteor scatter, it's got aurora, it's got everything. Just tune around the right time. So I am guessing the majority of the noise you're getting, Lou, is probably 60 cycle power noise. And 60 cycle power noise, if you look at it with a real good oscilloscope connected to your IS strip of your receiver, you'll see that it's got some very sharp spikes to it. And the noise blanker, a good noise blanker, is going to take out 97% of that. So that, in my opinion, is the beginning of getting around the local noise. Choose the right noise blanker. And many a noise blanker, what it really is just a simple diode limiter circuit in the audio or IF strip. And that's much too late. When that sharp spike of very fast ride time noise gets into your receiver, let me drop. The very first thing it does, it takes the very first tune stage of your IF strip and sets it ringing. So that spike, the spike may have a ride time of 100 picoseconds, you know, tenth of a nanosecond. But it's enough of, it's like hitting a bell with a hammer. It sets your IF strip ringing, and your IF strip will ring for the next millisecond. And what this Dracar 4C receiver does is it's got a completely parallel channel that senses the fact that a strong rise time, fast event took place, and it opens up a noiseless switch that's at the front end of the IF strip of the receiver during that microsecond of the rise. It blanks out that spike of fast rise energy before it gets into the first IF stage and sets it ringing. And the switch itself has no ring to it. It's like a doubly balanced mixer type thing. So once you kill the signal, at exactly the right instant when it's starting to come into your receiver, and tremendous improvement takes place. Now, let's see what as I said, Mel has been doing a lot of experimenting with noise blanking, and let's see what he's got to say about this one. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Sporadic noise literally is almost impossible many times to do, you know, a heck of a lot with it. What I use is the QRN washer, which consists of two antenna inputs. One is your signal that you use from an antenna that is receiving the signal directly from the station that you're talking to. And the other one is pointed at the noise source. And it goes through the QRN washer, it fades out, and then goes through a Q multiplier that brings the signal back up to whatever level you may have lost by going through the process of the QRN washer circuit. They've been pretty popular. There have been a number of articles printed on homebrewing versions, or a couple of companies are now producing them commercially. However, 6 meters, let me let it drop. Okay, 6 meters last week at Field Day, we put up the beam, my beam that I put up every year for 6 meters, and we did some real serious 6 meter operation. Fortunately, there wasn't much in the way of band openings or whatever, but we did work, managed to work everything on 6 meters. Possibly here. The rig we were using, which seems to really do a phenomenal job with noise. In fact, I have the same rig here. Didn't have to use mine, but I have the exact radio, and I noticed that it does become extremely effective in noise blanking on 6 meters. It's the ICOM IC706 Mark IIG. Now, I have it with the filters. I have the mechanical filters in it. For both sideband and CW, and with the noise blanket combination, it really does a phenomenal job, Dick. I think it'll equal anything that we've seen in the past, of course, the hard piece of equipment, but it works phenomenally on 6 meters, Dick, over.
So would you say, Joe, I mean, Mel, that power line noise that you heard on your street, on Dover Street, or that you heard at the Floyd Bennett Field, 60 cycle noise with its spikes,